From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And we start with that new order from Attorney General William Barr. It concerns asylum seekers at the southern border who don't come through legal ports of entry. They come between those crossings. Barr says that even if they establish a credible fear of persecution or torture in their home country, they must be denied bail, in other words, detained or jailed. It's aimed at stopping catch and release. That's the practice of catching migrants crossing illegally and then, if they qualify for an asylum hearing, releasing them on bail while they await trial. The Barr mandate won't go into effect for 90 days to allow border officials to get ready, but since holding centers are over capacity, it's unclear where these asylum seekers will go. Alora Mukherjee is a professor at the Columbia Law School, where she also directs the school's Immigrants' Rights Clinic. Professor, we know this no-bail mandate from Barr does not apply to families or children. A recent court order says they have to be released on bail in 20 days. It doesn't apply to people not seeking asylum. They can be deported. It applies to asylum seekers crossing outside the points of entry. What does the law, the Immigration and Nationality Act, say about that?
Well, U.S. immigration law recognizes that asylum seekers may enter the United States at designated ports of entry where there are Customs and Border Patrol agents, and also that asylum seekers may enter the United States in the spaces between designated ports of entry. And unless William Barr's order is successfully challenged in court, it will result in thousands of asylum seekers being detained for indefinite periods of time, potentially months and months, while their immigration cases are pending.
Of course, this will be challenged in court, but what legal basis does he have?
There seems to be little legal basis for Attorney General Barr's order. Section 236 of the Immigration and Nationality Act explicitly provides for those individuals who have passed their credible fear interviews to be eligible for bond. The statute says that the Department of Homeland Security may, not must, may detain these individuals or may release them on bond or conditional parole. The Attorney General's reading of the statute is at odds with its plain language and the way that the statute has been interpreted for years.
Well, but you said a few things there. You said that it does say that they may detain these people, and he is obviously taking them up on that. And you also said that they must pass this initial test proving that they have a credible claim of persecution or torture if they return. So these are people who have made it through that gate. They've proven that they have a reason to ask for asylum, and Barr is saying they still should not be given bail or bond and must be jailed. We thought another court in Washington just last month ruled that people with this credible claim of a need for asylum had to be able to seek bail to be released from any kind of detention within 7 days of requesting that bail. Does Barr's edict overrule that?
You're exactly right. A federal court in Washington state ruled that asylum seekers who've passed their credible fear interview must be given a bond hearing within 7 days. And there is obvious tension between those two decisions, but the federal court injunction has greater weight.
Look, the president and Attorney General William Barr and Jeff Sessions before Barr have all said that the asylum system needs to be fixed. The president said it's being abused, and this is an attempt to stop these people who are coming through, not through legal ports of entry. We understand a lot of them are actually looking for border agents. They're trying to turn themselves in because the legal ports of entry, many of them are so backed up. But devil's advocate, doesn't the president have a point that something has to be done with the people who are not coming through the legal ports of entry?
Yes, there are many things that should be done to fix our broken immigration system. We should be treating asylum seekers who are fleeing the worst dangers imaginable. We should be treating them humanely when they come to our borders. We should be offering them shelter and support and upholding our best American ideals and our international treaty obligations under the Refugee Convention. We should not be locking up asylum seekers who are fleeing for their lives in immigration detention centers, which are often located in remote areas where they do not have access to counsel, where there is hardly any access to interpreters who can help them figure out how to apply for asylum. The priorities of the administration are not in line with recognizing the humanity of the people who are fleeing to the United States in an effort to save their lives. And I want to go back to the statutory interpretation point. The Immigration and Nationality Act says that the Department of Homeland Security may detain asylum seekers, but it also provides for immigration judges to release these individuals under bond or on conditional parole. And Attorney General Barr, in his decision yesterday, says that the Department of Homeland Security must detain these individuals, which is contrary to the language of the statute.
Elora Mukherjee, a professor at Columbia Law School, where she also directs the school's Immigrants' Rights Clinic. Professor Mukherjee, thank you so much.
Thank you, Robin.
Well, on Friday, the Bureau of Land Management is holding an adoption and sale event near Prescott, Arizona, to try to find homes for wild horses. Horses represent the history of the American West, but the number of wild horses is at record levels, and ranchers don't want them competing with cattle for grazing land. Nate Hedgie from member station KUER reports on how the government is trying to control the population.
Rob Hammer's Jeep lurches over big rocks and ruts.
I know it seems bad right now, but it'll get worse.
We're heading deep into the greasewood and sage desert of western Utah looking for the Anakie Mountain herd of wild horses. Their proximity to Salt Lake City makes them a popular herd for tourists and amateur photographers like Hammer, so it doesn't take too long before we find some of them.
That's a pretty good size herd.
Hammer pulls his Jeep over, pops a piece of nicotine gum into his mouth, and gets out. The Mustangs are grazing on a hill overlooking desert mountains flushed green with spring. We're really close to them, but they barely seem to notice us. Unlike many wild horses, they're used to tourists. A couple of foals kick and play with each other, and Hammer isn't taking pictures. He's just standing there, soaking it all in.
Well, it's very peaceful. And if you, just stay still and enjoy it for a while, you almost start to feel like you're part of it.
These wild horses are descendants of escapees from the wagon trains and cavalry regiments that plodded across this desert more than a century and a half ago. And right now, they're thriving. The Bureau of Land Management estimates wild horse populations across the American West grow by 20% every year. Right now, they number around 70,000. The animals are protected under a 1971 federal law, but that law also mandated population limits. And today, the animals' numbers are way, way above those limits.
These horses do not have a natural predator.
That's rancher Mark Winch. He's head of the Utah Cattlemen's Association, and he's not too happy about this population boom. He says ranchers have to share public lands with the animals. That means losing forage and money.
Ranchers have paid for that grass. We use it. We have a right to it.
Cattlemen have long called for the Bureau of Land Management to aggressively reduce the number of wild horses on the range. That plea is getting louder as the number of wild horses grows exponentially. But how do you regulate the herds? You can't hunt them. That's illegal. So the BLM holds roundups. Horses are corralled using bait or helicopters, contained in holding facilities, and put up for adoption. But adoptions are slow, and many of the holding facilities are already full of horses. Plus, advocates say some adopted horses end up at Mexican or Canadian slaughterhouses. In this ad from the American Wild Horse Campaign, the advocacy group says the roundups themselves are dangerous.
Families are separated, foals are left behind.
There is one solution that horse advocates and ranchers agree on: contraceptives. Essentially, shooting mares in the butt with a dart that makes them infertile for a year. That's what Tim Clark is preparing to do right now. We're out near some tourist-friendly horses in Utah's windy Anakie Mountains. He's filling up a vial with a contraceptive PZP.
Don't ask me what it stands for. I couldn't tell you without the book.
Clark is a former law enforcement agent with the U.S. Forest Service. Now he's volunteering with the BLM to help administer the contraceptive to this group. Clark pops a vial into his air gun and begins walking slowly towards a mare. He stops, aims, and gently squeezes the trigger.
Got her.
Yeah.
The now empty dart falls to the ground as the horse runs away. Clark and the two other volunteers hope to shoot around a dozen horses today. The contraceptives will help slow down the growth of the herd. But the BLM says it only works with horses that aren't skittish because you have to get really close. Plus, the process is tedious and the animals have to receive fertility control vaccines every year.
So you can't just do it once and be like, whoa, we're good.
That's Lisa Reed. She's a spokesperson for the BLM. She says the program works for some of the human-friendly horses, but for those that aren't used to us,
you're not able to approach those animals and effectively take photographs, let alone administer birth control of any sort.
That's why the BLM is still planning to round up more than 300 wild horses near Utah's Anoki Mountains. Advocates held a protest against the roundup recently, but volunteer Tim Clark understands where the BLM is coming from.
They're kind of strapped between a rock and a hard place.
He says the agency is trying to strike a tricky balance between frustrated ranchers, frustrated advocates, and management objectives. With the subject as politically fraught as any in America these days, finding that balance isn't easy. For Here and Now, I'm Nate Hedgie.
And Nate's story comes to us from the Mountain West News Bureau. As we wait for the release tomorrow of Special Counsel Robert Mueller's edited report on the Russia investigation, a Monmouth University poll out today shows that President Trump's approval rating has dropped 4 points over the last month to 40%. His disapproval rating has gone up 3 points to 54%. Let's bring in our political strategist, Jamal Simmons, Democratic strategist and host at Hill TV. Hi, Jamal.
Good afternoon.
And Matt Makowiak, Republican strategist. He's in Austin, Texas today. Hi, Matt.
Hi there.
So let's listen to President Trump this week speaking to Minnesota's KSTP-TV about the release tomorrow of the redacted Mueller report.
There can't be anything there because there was no crime. There was no anything. The crime was committed by the other side. This crime was all made up. It was all a fabrication.
Matt, do you think there's going to be nothing there tomorrow when this gets released?
Well, I think the question is whether the release of the report, the redacted version, really changes the story in any meaningful way. I imagine Jamal and I actually agree on this in the sense that I'm interested to know if there is, more evidence on the obstruction question. It appears that Mueller believed there was evidence on both sides of that and that ultimately he left it up to the attorney general to determine whether obstruction charges should be brought. It would be interesting to see whether Mueller explains why he left that up to the attorney general. I know there's going to be a lot of interest in these so-called peripheral third parties who are going to have information redacted. I think what this is about, it's clear that the Mueller inquiry is not going to lead to charges against the president or any additional individuals. I think Democrats up on Capitol Hill are looking for additional things to investigate and perhaps even seek impeachment charges down the line. And that's what they're looking for in this report. And so in any report of 400 pages, I'm sure there are going to be bad facts. Mm. The question is, what are those facts and where does the story go from here?
Jamal, what do you think? And are you worried that this is going to be, for Democrats, a letdown, kind of like the Barr letter about the Mueller report was?
Well, I had heard that it was just going to be a series of quotes saying, Carter Page came in, he convinced us nothing happened, check. Okay, the lawyer came in, he convinced us nothing happened, check. Obviously, I'm kidding. There's no way we're going to have 400 pages of Donald Trump as the greatest human to ever be on the planet. We're going to find out that some of the things that we saw in public, from the president saying to Lester Holt, I fired James Comey because of the Russia thing, to whatever the other things are that, all the things that we've heard about over the course of the last couple of years, Jared Kushner trying to get a back channel in the Russian embassy to talk to Russia outside the purview of the American intelligence services. All those things we are going to hear about and maybe get some context about them. The thing for Democrats to remember is that it may not change the legal prospects for Donald Trump, but it is their responsibility to hold the president to political judgment, and they're going to have to do that. I don't know if that means he should be impeached, but it certainly means that we have to know more.
But do you think, Jamal, that they're going to have the appetite to do that as we get closer and closer to the election? And it seems pretty clear that Nancy Pelosi believes that the Democrats are better off focusing their attention on issues like health care.
Well, that holding his feet to the fire may occur on Election Day, and so that's something that Democrats have to really think through. The question is, we don't know what we don't know, and so it's hard to have a conversation without seeing what the facts are. And what we may find is that the president is not criminally liable for being a conspirator with a foreign power, but we may find that he is, in fact, a national security risk because he is so compromised that any foreign power could leverage itself against him.
I want to ask about Minnesota freshman Ilhan Omar, who's been in the news this week. She's one of two Muslim women in Congress. Continues to be a lightning rod even within her own party after she referred to the 9/11 terrorist attacks as some people did something. Last night on CNN, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi was asked about critics in the Democratic Party who say she wasn't swift enough to defend Omar after President Trump tweeted out images showing Omar juxtaposed with the 9/11 attacks. Here's Pelosi.
Well, I haven't had a chance to speak with her. I'm traveling, she's traveling, but we couldn't catch up with her until I talked to somebody. I don't even know what was said, but I do know what the president did was not right.
Okay, I want to hear from both of you on this, but Matt, let's start with you. What do you make of this whole back and forth between the president, Ilhan Omar, and now Nancy Pelosi?
Yeah, I mean, Pelosi's been interesting, particularly in the last few days. You know, she sort of sought to minimize the impact that some of these freshmen, some of the louder freshman members in her caucus are making, including Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Rashida Tlaib, and of course, Ilhan Omar. You know, what's interesting is I think you saw Democrats criticize some of the anti-Semitic remarks that Congresswoman Omar made previously. You have seen Democrats stay pretty pretty unified on this question. So, look, I think, you know, members of Congress who are freshmen generally don't have much impact. These particular members are certainly getting a lot of attention. And I think you can argue that AOC has moved the debate, particularly on the issue of the Green New Deal, more effectively than most freshmen do. I just think you got to be really careful when you're talking about 9/11. And if she was trying to make some other point, she needed to clarify that. And she just doesn't really ever do that. She doesn't clarify. She doesn't back down. She sort of doubles down over and over and over again. And that's part of what makes her a lightning rod.
Jamal, what do you think? And do you think that Pelosi is trying to be very careful here about getting behind Omar too much?
What I think is that Donald Trump doesn't really care about 9/11. ABC News had a report that he did not actually make any donations after 9/11 to any of the 9/11 charities. Donald Trump isn't doing this because he thinks it's going to make the country safer. He isn't doing this because it's going to help Ilhan Omar be a better representative because he's actually putting her life at risk because people are threatening to do something about her. Donald Trump is only doing this because this is the kind of chaos and confusion that helps Donald Trump. What we have learned about this president over and over again is that whatever the situation is, he looks for the only advantage that puts Trump first. And we have to always kind of pay attention to what he's getting out of the deal. And the deal for him is chaos is better for Donald Trump.
Okay, let's spend the last few minutes we have talking about 2020. President Trump's reelection campaign raised $30 million in the first quarter, we learned. Democratic contender Bernie Sanders raised around $18 million in the first quarter. And then there was this Fox News town hall in Pennsylvania on Monday night, and host Bret Baier seemed a little taken aback when he polled audience members about Bernie Sanders' health care for all proposal, which conservatives call socialist. Here's what happened.
Okay, now of those, how many are willing to transition to what the senator says, a government-run system?
Matt, what do you take away from that? This was a Fox News town hall, and people seem to like Medicare for All.
Yeah, and I don't know how the audience was selected. Generally, they would, you know, try to have a cross section.
Yeah, he said it was independents, Republicans, and Democrats in the crowd.
Sure, yeah, and I imagine it was, you know, sort of the Democrats or the liberals who were cheering loudest. Mm-hmm. But I don't think that's representative of the country. Look, I hope Democrats run on Medicare for All. I hope they run on kicking, 80 or 100 million people off of their employer-based health insurance, because that's what it would require. And Sanders was asked over and over and over again, almost to the point where it was uncomfortable, how he would pay for the plan. I saw a report just the last couple of days that all of Bernie Sanders' spending plans would require a $20,000 payment or tax increase for every American. So, I will give Bernie Sanders credit. I mean, going on Fox and doing that town hall makes all the sense in the world. You want to reach some of those voters who voted for Trump but might be willing to look at another populist candidate. Fox had massive ratings, and that town hall had the highest ratings of any of the town halls that the different cable networks have done. So, you know, good for him going on Fox. I think Mayor Pete's looking at it and others as well, and I think more candidates should do that.
So, Jamal, what do you think? And are you worried? There are a lot of stories in the press right now about Democrats being worried about how well Bernie Sanders is doing in the contest so far.
Oh, I'm not worried. I think Bernie Sanders should do well. He has been a one of the leaders on the progressive side for some of the ideas that we've talked about as a country. And now, you know, we were talking about how much should we cut taxes for rich people. Now we're having a national dialogue about how much more taxes should rich people pay. We're having a national dialogue not about how we get rid of Obamacare, but now we're talking about do we add another public option, or do we find another way to make sure that everybody in the country has health care? And I think we have to thank Bernie Sanders for that. I'm not convinced he's going to be the Democratic nominee just because history, profile, there are all sorts of reasons I can go through about why I think he won't make it. But I think his ideas have infused themselves into the Democratic Party, and they're where a lot of people who feel left out by the current system want to be because they need some help.
Okay, I want to ask about one more thing that happened this week in 2020 politics. This is Mayor Pete, who we just heard about, South Bend, Indiana, Mayor Pete Buttigieg. He was in Iowa after announcing his campaign. He had a pretty big crowd. He was also heckled by anti-gay protesters. He's an openly gay mayor. Here's happened.
Speaking of things, hello again. Speaking of things that are at stake that do not belong to a single political party.
They were saying, remember Sodom and Gomorrah, Pete. Jamal, what do you think about this? I mean, this is sort of bound to happen, I guess, at some point. He'd have to address the people who believe that he shouldn't be president because he's openly gay.
Absolutely. He was always going to have to address it. He gave a pretty compelling set of remarks just about a week ago where he talked about how if there was any way he could not have been gay, he would have chosen that path in a heartbeat. But God made him gay. And if you got a problem with him being gay, you got to take it up with God, not with him. I thought it was an incredibly compelling argument. And I think he showed what he has always showed while people like him is that even though he's the youngest person in the race, he seems to be the most mature. And when people act childish and call out in a rally, he handled him like an adult. Mm-hmm. And that's what I think a lot of Democrats respect.
Jamal Simmons, Democratic strategist and host at Hill TV. And we've also been speaking with Matt Mikowiak, Republican strategist. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you. Have a good day.
This message comes from Here and Now sponsor, Ember Wave. Ember Wave, the revolutionary personal thermostat that is designed to help you feel cooler or warmer at the press of a button. Ember Wave can put you in control in places like your freezing office, uncomfortable airplanes, restaurants, trains, cafes, and more. Named one of Time Magazine's best inventions of 2018, learn more at emberwave.com and use code NPR to save $50 at checkout. Ember Wave. Control your comfort.
Americans made 9.9 billion trips on public transit last year, according to new figures from the American Public Transportation Association. It sounds like a lot, but it's a 2% decrease in ridership compared to the year before. So what does this mean for transit systems? Here now, transportation analyst Seth Kaplan is here. Hi, Seth.
Hi, Robin.
So break this down for us. Are all kinds of public transit seeing this decline, all cities?
Most of them are, but certain modes of transit, as they're called, just types of vehicles are seeing it more than others. So if you look at rail, this is what they call heavy rail. That would be like a subway system or light rail, the trains that kind of share space with cars. Mm-hmm. Those are both down 3% nationally. Bus ridership, down 2% nationally. The good news, commuter rail, so these are rail lines that connect typically suburbs with cities, if you picture Metra in Chicago or Metro North, the Long Island Railroad, New Jersey Transit in New York, those are actually up fractionally.
Yeah. Well, but the population is growing and more people are moving to cities. So what's going on? And am I thinking correctly when I think Uber, Lyft?
Yeah, that's part of it. And what's interesting is that when you look at different cities, you would think it would track population growth, wouldn't you? But a city like Atlanta that's adding population, you know, bus ridership down there, 12%. Overall ridership there, down 8%. On the other hand, a city like Pittsburgh, not a fast growth city, kind of a bright spot that this report highlighted, up 3% for bus, 2% overall. But yeah, part of it is gasoline prices. If you kind of look back historically, when gasoline gets real expensive, it gets expensive to drive, kind of pushes people onto transit. Right now, that's moderate. But I think you hit the nail on the head. Mm. Uber and Lyft. These systems, these transit systems, which are subsidized, are for the first time competing against something else that's actually, in a different way, very heavily subsidized. Uber and Lyft lost almost $3 billion last year. Mm. So, you know, by people paying less for now than it costs to carry them, as long as the investors tolerate it there, that those cheap rides also competing against transit systems.
Yeah, well, that may not last. But, you know, there are people who just, you know, have been turning up their noses at public transit for a while because in some cities they are kind of run down. But the idea was if more people got on public transit, it's going to be better for the environment. You know, more people in one vehicle going to wherever they're going. So what is the overall takeaway from this?
Exactly, Robin. You're right. I mean, picture, you know, dozens of people together on one bus or hundreds of people together on one train. You just can't compete against that in environmental terms, just in terms of how much space you take up. You know, take all those people on a bus and put them all in cars on the city street, right? So it's an issue. And some urbanists had been optimistic that Uber and Lyft, kind of by just making it easier to live in cities, would actually end up helping transit systems, even though they kind of compete against them. Because yeah, people moving back into cities should help. But for now, the simple math is that even in places where the population is growing, in almost all of them, transit ridership is down, and in some cases, down significantly.
Less than a minute, actually half a minute. Seth, what should cities do?
Well, they have to avoid what you might call a death spiral, which is that because ridership is down, look, it's tough. You know, it costs the same to run the system roughly, no matter how many people are riding it. So right. The temptation is raise fares, but then that just pushes more people off transit. So continued investment is what it would take.
Yep.
And just sort of reacting quickly to a world that's changing quickly with systems that weren't always designed for quick changes. Those rail lines have been there for a really long time.
Seth Kaplan, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
Well, let's take a break from the news now for another edition of the Here and Now DJ Sessions.
There goes the last DJ.
Dance, little DJ, come on.
David Summerstein is a DJ at North Country Public Radio in Canton, New York, and host of the program The Beat Authority. Hi, David.
Hey, Jeremy, how's it going?
It's going well. And all the songs you have brought us are, as you put it, dance grooves from all over the world. How did you get into this genre?
I was living in Spain in the late 80s and just sort of found these musicians then who were just mixing different beats from all over the world, especially Mano Negra. Mm-hmm. You may know the guy Manu Chao.
Right, Manu Chao.
Yeah, and that just sort of led to an exploration of like Latin alternative and African music. And, you know, I like to explore where all these traditions sort of intersect and then mix with like hip hop tradition and electronic music.
Okay, well, let's listen to some of the ones that you brought us. This is called Barokan. This is by Jelly Tapa.
Horomuso londo mo temeto akomanye mungeli ala ngo sra barokanye mro how I fly grilla yo horomuso londo mo valyo. Horomuso samara kilindo mbalu mbe imaye fla barokanye mlo.
What a cool sound there. Jelly Tapa, by the way, is from Mali, currently living in Montreal.
Yeah, and Montreal has been like this natural destination for immigrants from Francophone Africa for generations because of the French, obviously. Mm-hmm. And it's now home to North America's largest African music festival, Nuit d'Afrique. So what you have year-round in Montreal is this just great intermingling and sampling and sharing of all these African-Canadian musicians. such as Jelly Tapa, who is from a family of griots in Mali. She's been living in Montreal since 2004. And the producer of this album is this guy, Caleb Rimtobai, who goes by Afrotronics. And he's this producer. You'll see him dressed in these cool, futuristic outfits on stage, almost like Captain Kirk. And they talk about this sort of Afrofuturism. And what I love about this music is Tapa's voice is so powerful over this sort of pulsating, echoey music. And it's electronic and futuristic without sounding remixy, you know, also maintaining the music's traditional roots.
And what is a family of griots?
A family of griots is... griots are the traditional keepers of music in Malian culture and much of West African culture, passing it on from generations to generations, performing at weddings and other ceremonies. Yeah.
So the next one you brought us is called El Terron. This is by The Bongo Hop featuring Nidia Gongora.
Todo un paisaje se refleja así. El atardecer trae su propia magia y la sultana llueve ver desde estas lindas montañas bonitas llenas de color y de gente linda, solidaria y con sabor, 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 sabor. Ay, hermanita, te invito yo a ver la sultana y el encanto del terror. Sabor, sabor, sabor. Ay, hermanita, te invito yo.
All of a sudden, I feel like it's hotter outside.
Oh, yeah. This is just like, this is a total banger on the club dance floor, you know, when I play this, when I DJ. People just lock into that groove. And it is like this collaboration between French trumpetist Etienne Savé, who's from Lyon, France. But he lived for many years in Cali, Colombia. And his neighbor was veteran producer Quantic, who produces sort of global beats from all over the world, mixing these cultures. And Quantic introduced him to Nidia Gongora, who has that amazing voice. She was singing in a folkloric group when she met Quantic, and, you know, her career really blew up from there. She has such a distinctive voice.
Okay, well, the next one you wanted us to hear is called Tata Fatigue. This is by Vodou Game. This almost sounds like it could be from the 1970s.
Yeah, absolutely. Pure Afro-funk and definitely in the tradition of James Brown. And it's the brainchild of this guy named Peter Solo, who is Togolese, living also in Lyon, France, coincidentally. And Solo's mother is a voodoo priestess. His father is Catholic, so he sort of grew up in both worlds, and he plays what he calls voodoo funk, you know, which is mixing James Brown and American soul music with what he says are like the rhythms of voodoo ceremonies that he took part in his home country. And this whole album is just, and the song is just crazy funky with a really sweet, just analog sound that is perfect for dancing.
Lyon, France, by the way, I went to when I was a kid and had the first ever coq au vin that I have ever had, and it became my favorite dish of all time. Lyon is, of course, the culinary capital of Europe, many would say, but also, obviously, a lot of music coming out of Lyon.
Yeah, culinary mix of great music
right.
as well.
Okay, the last one that you brought us is a new single from the Big Six Brass Band in New Orleans. This is called The Mind.
Thank you.
Now, people who know New Orleans know this is the sound of the city. The Big Six like to play in the streets, in parking lots, even in a Popeyes. Recently, yeah, a video showed that.
On Twitter.
Tell us why you picked this one, and how did you first encounter the Big Six?
Yeah, so it's festival season in New Orleans. Mardi Gras has passed us, and now it's Jazz Fest next month. And I was just in New Orleans a few weeks ago visiting a friend, and she said, you got to check out the Big Six Brass Band. This is like the next hot second line band. Mm-hmm. And I went to a second line. It's a sort of Sunday tradition in New Orleans where, mm-hmm. you know, bands just sort of take over the streets. They publish the route and anyone can catch up and march along, and they go for miles over 3 hours. And it just like they take ordinary neighborhood streets and transform them into like something really powerful and beautiful, people owning the streets. So the Big Six is like one of these new bands. It's a very young musician's game because you got to be out there blowing your horn in the hot sun. And I just love the, they have a lot of hip hop influence. A lot of brass bands do these days. But I just love the energy and the party atmosphere of the Big Six.
Seems like you also love France because all of these songs have some French connection.
Yeah, you know, it just kind of coincidentally happened. But, you know, there are so many different cultures mixing in France, especially in Paris and apparently Lyon, and also music that has gone out to other parts of the world, like New Orleans, where things are continuing to move along. And there just happens to be a real deep, danceable, funky groove in a lot of sort of mm-hmm. French-derived music these days.
That is David Summerstein, who hosts the program The Beat Authority at North Country Public Radio in Canton, New York. David, thanks so much.
Oh, so much fun. Thanks a lot, Jeremy.
And how nice to have so much music with ties to France, as we're all thinking about France after the fire at Notre Dame. You're listening to Here and Now.
In one of the world's largest one-day elections, Indonesian President Joko Widodo is on track to win a second term, an apparent victory over his rival, the former general Prabowo Subianto. The two men also faced off against each other in 2014. We've been watching India's election, which spans many days, almost 900 million people. Indonesia has 193 million eligible voters, but it's spread out over thousands of islands. Some ballots were delivered by helicopter and horse. And it's home to the world's largest Muslim population. The BBC's Karishma Vaswani is in Jakarta. And Karishma, you say this is the world's most complicated one-day election.
Yeah, you know, this has been a really massive logistical challenge for Indonesia's election commission to try and pull off this very complex election in just one day. In the past, what we've typically seen is that the legislative elections, the parliamentary elections take place in April, and the presidential and vice presidential elections take place a few months after that, typically in July. But this time around, the Election Commission decided to put it all together in one day, mainly to save money and make the process more efficient. And that's meant that they've had to send some 800,000 polling booths across this archipelago. Election official commission representatives have had to reach some of the furthermost territories of the archipelago at times by foot, by horseback, by boat. And so it has been a really impressive feat of democracy and a testimony to the fact that just 20 years on from when Indonesia was a dictatorship, it has become a thriving and vibrant democracy. And Indonesians are very proud of that democratic process.
Well, and would you say Widodo's victory, as many are, is a symbol of that moderation and progressivism winning over, well, fear? Subianto, who again lost, was said to have run a fear-based campaign. He's a nationalist, whereas Widodo was trying to reduce poverty, build the infrastructure.
Yeah, you know, that would have certainly been true of President Joko Widodo back in 2014, Robin, when he really did campaign on a message of unity and the idea that he represented the aspirations of the common man here in Indonesia. Remember, he's not from the military elite that typically gets ahead in Indonesian politics. He doesn't have those political connections. He was a furniture seller and a small town mayor. So when he came to power in 2014, that was the hope, certainly, about Joko Widodo's presidency, but he's disappointed a lot of his supporters. He's been under pressure to prove that he's Muslim enough because of a growing piety in Indonesian society and also a clamor for more political power by Islamic groups. And as a result, he has had as his running mate, he's picked as his running mate, a hardline cleric, a 76-year-old man called Maruf Amin. And that's raised some concerns about the kind of agenda that he may have in his second term.
And would he or his supporters say that maybe he had to tack to the right because of the huge Muslim population and demand for more representation, but also because his opponent was leaning so far to the right?
Yeah, I think that that would be a fair, an accurate representation of why he may have felt compelled to capitulate and appease his voters that he is Muslim enough by taking on this very unusual and controversial at the time running mate. His opponent, Prabowo Subianto, has courted hardline Muslim groups. You can see many of the flags of these hardline groups at his rallies. He has promised to bring back a radical cleric who is in self-imposed exile in Saudi Arabia if he is elected. And most notably, he and many hardline groups were responsible for the jailing and conviction of Joko Widodo's former ally, the Chinese-Indonesian politician Basuki Cahayapurnama, also known as Ahok, who was sentenced for blasphemy back in 2017. And that's really been what's considered as the turning point in Indonesian politics, when identity politics really came to the forefront.
Well, and as we said, Widodo is on track to win his second term. When will we know officially? And is there any chance there'll be an upset?
Well, the official results aren't released till next month. But typically, in previous Indonesian elections, quick count results, which are effectively the official results from around 2,000 or a few thousand polling booths across the archipelago, representative polling booths, they've been very accurate in the past. So unless there is a major difference between the quick count results of the dozen or so pollsters that we've seen today, all pointing largely to a victory for President Joko Widodo, unless there's a difference between these results and what we see from the Election Commission, it is very clear that President Joko Widodo has won a decisive victory today.
The BBC's Karishma Vaswani there in Jakarta, Indonesia. Karishma, thank you.
You're very welcome, Robin.
Taking you around the world. Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here Now.